The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. An exciting weekend in the Premier League. Two shots is all Leeds need to win at the Etihad. But when will Stuart Dallas and his friends burn out? The race for the top four hots up. The all-new Jesse Lingard fires West Ham within a point of the party boys, Leicester City. Cavani and Pogba excel for Manchester United at Spurs. There are many questions, mainly about whether the game has gone, and if so, where, and on the rights and wrongs of providing your own children with adequate sustenance. Meanwhile, Trent Alexander-Arnold scores and is therefore back as England's number one right back. At the bottom, a huge win for Newcastle United. What more do their fans want? 6 points clear of Fulham now. Scott Parker creating more lyrics for Mike Skinner as every game goes by. Elsewhere, we've got players headbutting their teammates, Phil Brown's new look, some physics, online Scrabble, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max.
Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you very much. Hello, Barney Ronay.
Hi, Max. Hello, everyone.
A question from Tig, who says, am I the only one who still listens to the podcast, but really doesn't have that much interest in actually watching any matches these days? Well, I don't know, but we'd prefer it was that way round, to be honest. So very happy to let you know everything that has happened over the weekend. And we'll begin at the Etihad. Manchester City 1, Leeds United 2. Didn't necessarily do anything to the league table, did it? Leeds will finish mid-table. Manchester City will win the league. But Wilson, that's a stunning performance and a great result for Bielsa.
Yeah, I thought Leeds were really good. And I thought what was interesting was as soon as Cooper is sent off, Bielsa, yeah, there doesn't appear to be any sort of thought, there's no dithering. Bielsa immediately decides, and I suppose he had the VAR delay to work it out, takes off Bamford. And I'm not sure how many managers would do that, to take off your centre forward to shore up the defence. I think most managers would leave the central figure there so you can go along to him, so you've got that outlet. Whereas Bielsa chose to have that outlet in the wide areas with Rafinha and Helder Costa. And the benefit of that was seen in the winner, but also that opportunity they had when Fernandinho got booked for the cynical foul. And there was one other chance they created from that same movement of breaking out very quickly, getting the ball wide quickly. So I just sort of thought it's a fascinating insight into how he sees the game in a different way to other people. Because a lot of what they did was pretty standard, was they dropped men back and they played very deep. But the way they broke out with that, I thought was a very Bielsa way of doing it.
I thought that was a fascinating insight. I like that Barney stifled his first yawn of the pod within Jonathan, within Wilson's first answer. Stuart Dallas, Barney, is, I was going to say fun, and I know I'm not allowed to say that about Leeds anymore, but it's sort of an example of a player that I don't know how good Stuart Dallas is, but whenever I see him, I'm incredibly impressed.
I wasn't stifling a yawn. I was thinking. That was expression of deep and interested thought.
Okay, good. I think you're
trying to create some kind of opposition here.
I'm creating a narrative. I do apologize.
Barney was stifling a cheer.
Well, me and Barney famously hate each other. Let's just accept it. We've despised each other from day one.
Everyone knows that.
And the fact that we can put our differences aside to create vaguely audible content is a miracle.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was thinking that I think Bamford is a little bit injured, and that while we can spin a kind of genius tactical move out of it, it probably comes down to something a bit more prosaic as well as being a genius tactical move.
So he picks holes in my argument for no reason. Just everything I say, he's got to be against it.
No, I'm very tolerant of the answer is a genius narrative. Stuart Dallas. Leeds, there's this kind of culture wars thing about Marcelo Bielsa. It's very boring, where a certain kind of football supporter and journalist wants to say, well, it's the other one, and a certain other kind says, no, he's an absolute genius. There's no in between. And I think the reality is, as ever, somewhere in between. Players like Stuart Dallas emphasise how well he's done with this group and how he's brought a lot out of these players and the way he's got them to to follow him. And the wage bill in the Championship was not by any stretch the largest, but to get promotion is a really good feat. And to never at any stage this season to look in trouble in the Premier League and to have some really memorable performances. It's just a really good bit of management. It's not the act of a genius. It's not the act of a fraud. It's something that we should applaud and say this man is a really talented and a good addition. And Stuart Dallas looks like a man who is enjoying his life and football more than anyone else in the world right now. So I'm a big fan of him.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this game, as I'm sure everyone else who saw it did. And I was glad they served up a treat because their corresponding fixture before the turn of the year was, for my money, the best game of the season, but it kind of got lost. I think it was on the same weekend that Villa hockeyed Liverpool and Spurs battered Manchester United. So that they kind of captured the headlines. But this was wonderful. I think Bielsa probably summed it up well after the game when he said we deserve to win, but the fair thing would have been for City to win because Leeds did deserve to win and City also deserved to win. They created a lot more chances, couldn't score them. All the stats are sort of heavily weighted in City's favour. Leeds had two shots on and off target and scored with both of them. And it was a brilliant performance, one which I'm sure they'll be using on coaching courses, you know, at wherever it is they conduct coaching courses. England HQ, I think, isn't it? St. George's Park. So, yeah, but an absolutely terrific game, which I really, really enjoyed. And that's two Saturday lunchtime kickoffs in a row that have been fantastic and that in that much maligned time slot.
On your theory of football, Barry, Chris says, question for Barry, now that Leeds are better than Manchester City, should we give them the Premier League trophy now?
I would be absolutely, thoroughly in favour of giving them the Premier League trophy.
So do you stand by your football theory?
I wouldn't necessarily agree that Leeds were better than Manchester City in that game, but in my original theory where I was arguing that Newcastle are better than Everton because they beat them twice, Newcastle were emphatically better than Everton on both occasions.
Wilson, do you have anything to say about Barry's theory of football?
No. Well, you're league to league. And we know what the parameters of a league are, that you play every twice and you add up the points. And then you give one who's got the most the trophy. Now, you know, you can get into whether that's fair. In fact, there's a mate of mine who did a proper study on this and said that to cancel out the sort of vicissitudes of form and injuries and whatever, a season would have to be 35 years long to be statistically fair.
It's a great idea. You get two seasons in your lifetime.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you get half a season in your career and two in your lifetime. So yeah, I think it's reasonable there should be a cut off somewhere. 38 games seems to have worked over a period of 130 odd years. Doing it over two games, some would say, is too short. But you know, attention spans are dropping, and maybe that is the way we have to go. Just two super clubs endlessly slugging it out every week, the same two teams. I mean, like that league, is it the Isle of Scilly, where they have just two teams whose leagues play each other 18 times or something? And maybe that is it. Maybe that's the Orwellian future, just two superpowers endlessly smashing into each other.
In the 35-year season, how many games do you have to play to get a medal? Like, would at the end of the end of the 35 years, think how many
Mark Noble would probably qualify for one after
how many
making
players
his 400th appearance for West Ham at the weekend?
There's so many players on the open top bus.
But if you keep it as 10 games, or maybe you have to average 10 games a season, you have to play 350 games, which I would is something like what. 40 players in the whole history of the game have played 350 games for the same team in the Premier League.
Tottenham Hotspur 1, Manchester United 3. Manchester United were very good in the second half of this game, Barney, I thought.
Yeah, they were good. They always, this seems to, this is the theme of their away run, isn't it? They tend to just come on strong. There's a, one of the things Solskjaer has successfully done is to create a team that seems to be quite, for whatever its other flaws, to be quite free of anxiety and to believe in its own sort of capacity to come into games. And they do have a lot of good players, and eventually those good players will create some winning football. And that seems to be how it works. But I, this was also to do with how bad Tottenham were. I'm not, the thing that strikes me about them is just this kind of lack of joy. This kind of, every game feels like a burden. It feels like this terrible burden. There's that statement, that phrase, I think it was Johan Cruyff, who said in football, the clock is always your enemy because you're either ahead and you want the game to finish, or you're behind and the game's finishing too quickly. But I feel that with Spurs. I feel like the clock is their enemy from the first whistle, because there's this horrible yawning stretch of time that they have to do something in, and they don't know what that is, and they just want it to be over constantly, probably even when they're 3-0 up. It's really painful to watch. And it reminds me a little bit of England under Sven-Göran Eriksson as well, where the team with basically one idea, and when you've done that idea 5 or 6 times, you start to think, well, I'm not going to do this for another 85 minutes. Like, how are we going to keep this up? I would say the problem with Spurs is not just the manager, which people like to insist. I think a lot of the players are not really very good, and the squad's a bit thin and tired. But there's definitely the lack of joy helps other teams. And you always knew Man United were going to overwhelm them, and they did so very well.
Imagine if they had to do it for 35 years. then the clock would really be against it, wouldn't they? Barry, how good is Edinson Cavani's movement? Is it easier because the man who's standing next to him, Eric Dier, is completely stationary at all times?
I mean, he is fabled for the quality of his movement, for running into spaces and his sort of razor sharp anticipation of where the ball is going to be and getting there ahead of whoever is supposed to be marking him. When that person is Eric Dier, I suppose it makes his positioning and movement look even better. But he is a terrific player and has been for a very long time, and time sadly is his enemy because he's pushing on and doesn't have a huge amount of time left in the game. But you know, it's difficult to fault him. He's a top quality striker.
The football hipster says, with 3 great team goals against Spurs, not on the counter, is Jonathan Wilson starting to change his mind re United's attack?
Well, I think that's probably the best I've seen United play under Solskjaer, that second half. I thought they were really good. The way they played through the press, I thought was really impressive. But maybe that's just how bad Tottenham's pressing is. It's hard to tell. I was actually at this game, and I haven't been to very many games during lockdown. So the first 10 minutes, I was just sort of quite excited being there and seeing it. But then it actually became quite a hard game to write about, because I was certain Tottenham were going nowhere, and then suddenly they scored this brilliant team goal out of nowhere, having shown no sign that they had any idea how to break United down. They scored a sensational goal. Then they didn't do it again. So I think it probably was just a freak. But United were excellent. I mean, yeah, Cavani and Pogba I thought were brilliant. But the other thing that really amused me during the game was, and again, I guess people who are going to games regularly are now bored by hearing players all the time. But there was a great moment of Joe Roden. You could hear him shouting. Tottenham had a throw on the right just inside their own half. This, I think it was still at 1-1, the score. And you hear Joe Roden go, "No risks, no risks, no risks." And he gets thrown to Serge Aurier. He goes, "Oh, fuck off."
So Serge Aurier is one big risk, isn't he? Pogba was excellent, Barry. Kieran says, is there a term for the elite category of players who simply glide around the pitch? The likes of Pogba, Zidane, Yaya Toure, says Bellingham comes to mind. Gliders, skaters, swans, Fred Astaires, please advise.
There isn't one that I'm aware of. I have my personal theory is that performance by Pogba was entirely motivated by spite. And Jose Mourinho was in the opposite dugout. He doesn't like him, and he decided, I am going to play really well today. excellent Pogba performances are, you know, few and far between, but when he turns it on, there are few better. And I firmly believe that the only reason he played that well yesterday was just to shove it up to Jose Mourinho.
The
and
Larry I Davis.
Utterly applaud. I cannot applaud him enough for that. Johnson, you had an article in The Observer yesterday sort of about the cowardice behind latter-day Jose's tactics. And this game basically played out. It's like you'd scripted it just to prove a point.
Yeah, I mean, cowardice, I'm not sure is necessarily the word I'd use, but there's...
Isn't it the word you... Exactly the word you used?
No. I said he played with fear, which I think is a slightly less pejorative term. But yeah, I think it's 18 points now they've dropped from winning positions this season. Mm-hmm. But also, I think psychologically, the big game was the away game at Liverpool, when if they'd won, they'd have gone top of the table, which was back in December. And yeah, that game was 1-1, and Spurs were causing all kinds of bother on the break. Your Bergwijn had hit the post. There'd been Harry Kane header, which had bounced over the bar, and you sort of could, you know, with sort of a quarter of an hour to go, you could that game felt like it could go either way. At which he took off Bergwijn and brought on Reguilon, and so had two left backs on the pitch, presumably to pin back Trent Alexander-Arnold, which makes some kind of tactical sense, but just seemed to me to sort of be evidence of the fear taking over, that rather than gambling slightly for the potential of a win that would have taken them top of the table, he drops deeper, invites pressure, and that pressure eventually leads to a winner for Liverpool. And since then, Tottenham have plummeted. So that just seems to be every time Spurs play now, every time they get a lead, they just drop deeper and deeper, as they did yesterday. And you know, even the games against LASK in the Europa League and against Dinamo Zagreb, you know, going to Zagreb with a 2-0 lead and then sort of just playing with no attacking purpose, just allowing the waves of pressure. And defensively, they're not good enough to handle that. Now, whether that's Jose's fault for not organising them properly, whether that's to do with the quality of players, whether it's to do with the lack of investment, whether it's just modern football, you can't defend like that for protracted periods against really good sides. It isn't working, and yet he seems not merely unable to change, but ideologically to embrace doing that and deliberately to go down that path.
I have an interesting question on that theme, which occurred to me the other day. I just wonder why anyone in football has any fear of anything. It occurred to me, like, why does everyone seem to be so afraid of everything? If you're Jose Mourinho, for example, or any of top player, you've basically won a kind of lottery in life, and you've reached a stage where in your career where you're so incredibly wealthy now and so sort of projected across every surface that it doesn't really matter what you do. I thought about this when Big Sam the other day, we saw this carefree Big Sam who was going to send his team out to play with no fear. And, you know, while these players are all overcoached and micromanaged. It occurred to me, why doesn't that happen more often? Why don't we see loads of these people saying, well, I'm wealthy beyond my wildest dreams. I could retire tomorrow. I mean, I suppose in a way someone like Gareth Bale has said that. And he plays like a normal person. I would play like Gareth Bale. I would laugh on the bench and not really care because I have 50 million quid sitting in the bank. But why isn't there a great wave of carefree football and footballers and people laughing during the game and having a good time and sending their teams out to attack? Because none of these people are playing for a living. There's no jeopardy in their lives. They're rewarded beyond their wildest dreams. And yet Steve Bruce looks like he's going to die if you lose 2-1 to Watford. I mean, it literally doesn't matter, Steve. You know, you have this wonderful existence doing this. What is it, something to do with the bubble and the kind of paranoia of being stuck in it? And maybe social media as well. People constantly pounding away at you from the outside.
I do think it's a worry that of fear of criticism, I suspect.
But it's all, I think the bubble is exactly it. The kind of... All your contemporaries, all the people you're seeing, they're the people you're measuring yourself against. So you have your sort of circle, not necessarily your circle of friends, but the people you interact with on a daily basis. And you know, that sort of sets your level. So it must
happen. But are you more likely to fail if you play with a great carefree abandon, or more likely to fail if you feel incredibly worried about losing 2-1 to Watford. I mean, I think the real point is I'm talking nonsense. You don't get to that level without being incredibly driven and paranoid at every level that you cannot lose a single 50-50. You know, everything is really important. But, I mean, we're all human beings, and surely at some point, some part of you will say, well, it really doesn't matter what I do here. This is an incredible situation. And I'm allowed to play football for a living or to manage a team. And why don't I create something of just astonishing joy and freedom?
Well, I think it's a really interesting point. But I think there's also this, you know, the ridiculousness of the things that you are not allowed to do or that you get incredibly criticized for. You know, the things that are not done, which include, you know, smiling within 3 days of losing a football match or like being out in the days when we're allowed to go out at a thing with your family if you've lost 4 days before. In the same way, you know, it's ridiculous if you turn your back on a football coming at you at 200 miles an hour. These things that I think within the game, not just from the media, but within the game are sort of seen as totally outrageous, is why people aren't having more fun doing it. I completely agree with you.
But it presumably happens in Sunday League as well, right? You get people who, in their non-footballing lives, are incredibly successful in what, you know, whatever way, whether it's career-wise, whether it's family-wise, whatever. And then for 90 minutes on a Sunday, they turn to some kind of lunatic, madly driven, to convince the referee that that throw-in is actually theirs.
Yeah.
Whereas the normal thing, you know, the more realistic thing to do would be to go, actually, I couldn't give a shit which way this throwing goes. Like, I'm making 200 grand a year in my law job, and I've got a beautiful wife and two kids, and I'm in great health, and everything's fine.
I was once playing in a football match, and one of their players fouled our centre forward, and it was quite a bad foul. I sort of elbowed him in the neck, and I just said, mate, can you not elbow him in the neck? And he went, oh, fuck off. I went, relax. And he went, I am relaxed. I said, well, you don't appear it. He went, well, I earn 250 grand a year, so you can fuck off. I was like, that's a really weird thing to say on a football pitch. I was like, what do you do? And he went, bricks and fucking mortar, mate. I was like, okay, great, carried on. Anyway,
but isn't that exactly what the kind of thing professional footballers say to each other?
Yeah.
That was a glimpse into the real. But I don't, I mean, it's a stupid, naive point, but it would be nice to sit down with Jose Mourinho and just say, look, Jose, you've got nothing to lose. Like, you've won everything. Like, everyone thinks that you're this, or you know, you're kind of destroying the way people will see you. Why not create a two-season team of astonishing, you know, winning 6-4, kind of attacking brio, and just enjoy your life? Like, it doesn't have to be this paranoid nightmare.
But I think that's the point about Mourinho, is that it's now about vindication for him and sort of proving a point that his low block attritional approach is actually the right way to play, despite all evidence of the contrary since 2008.
Yeah, how's that one working out? Is it going
not
well?
Great? Listen, before we end part one, I want to talk about the thing that I imagine Barney has brought up, this point about people enjoying football. So we don't have time to talk about Scott McTominay's hand brushing Son's face and the game going. But I'm going to insist that we do. Malky says, does any of the panel agree with Lars that it was a foul by McTominay on Son? This leads to Cavani's goal that was disallowed.
Yes, I agree with that. When I was at school, I remember we were quite into these sort of Bruce Lee kung fu films, and there was always this idea of the one-inch punch. Bruce Lee was did this incredible thing, and you could do, at school, you were allowed to do that. You could punch people as hard as you like, as long as it was from 1 inch, and punch someone in the gut. And we all became incredible experts at the one-inch punch, where you could like break a brick in half. And who are we to say that Scott McTominay hasn't perfected the one-inch, and that tiny little flick of his fingernail could have actually broken through several slates, which is what Bruce Lee could hit. You'd hold the slates in front of your guts and he would break them. And so I think it was an appalling foul, and using his deadly skills in that way is shocking. He should probably be arrested.
Solskjaer says, if that was my son and he stays down and he needs 10 mates to help him up, he doesn't get food for a few days, because that's embarrassing. Mourinho said, I just want to say that Sonny is very lucky that his father is a better person than Ole. I am a father. I think as a father, you always have to feed your kids. Doesn't matter what they do. If you have to steal to feed your kids, you steal. Matt says, where does the panel stand on the issue of fathers feeding their children? Barney, as the only one with children, have you ever refused to feed your children?
This was a battle of people using idioms that they don't quite... that aren't really communicated properly. I mean, the cheese is cheese, bread is bread. That means, that's supposed to mean like a spade is, call a spade, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of a, That's a Portuguese idiom. But the thing about not feeding, starving, he was trying to say I'd send him to bed with no supper, wasn't he? It was kind of a figure of speech. It just came out a really unfortunate sort of piece of abusive parenting.
Ross says, which manager is most likely to starve his children?
Ollie's the one who talks about it all the time. This isn't the first time he's talked about it. But it just seems to me the foul is instigated by Son, right? Son tries to grab him, then he shrugs him off. And in that shrugging off, there's a very minor bit of contact. Now, maybe you know, it can, if you get hit in the face, no matter how sort of gently, it's a bit of a shock. So I'm not really blaming Son for going down. I'm slightly blaming him for staying down. But it's just one of those things that wouldn't even be seen if VAR didn't exist, that VAR's created this other world where we're suddenly examining things on a microscopic level that were never designed to be examined on a microscopic level. And I was thinking at the game, if you think of Paul Gascoigne and every run he did, it was like he was doing the breaststroke. He was constantly kind of moving his arms back into players. Like, Paul Gascoigne would never create a goal, never score a goal in the modern game because he was constantly smacking people in the chest and the face. And in the old days, that was just how you did it.
How do we feel about the phrase, the game has gone? Obviously, the game went at this moment. A lot of people said it had gone. Lars asked us, what will you talk about now the game has gone and where does the game go to and what does it get up to while it's there? Barca Jim said, is the game officially gone as everyone thought at halftime or did the second half mean it's still there? Magic Sponges says, if that's a foul and we should all go home, but no one goes home apart from the people who are already at home, what does that mean? I do like the phrase the game's gone because I just, you know, it's a real kind of end of tether moment for a lot of people on social media.
It's so what we're ridiculous. Saying, we're now saying the phrase "the game is gone" has gone. We can
no longer use it. My suspicion is, go on, Barney.
Well, I think it's actually I know there's this kind of again a kind of culture war stance on VAR where if you say you think it's depriving us of something that's fundamentally important in football, you're a kind of gammon and you're just this appalling person. You probably vote UKIP and you're on one side of some kind of imaginary divide. But I think it's important in this case that we do remember that these occasions are supposed to be essentially about bringing lots of human beings together in the same place. And it's a collective experience. It's kind of spontaneous joy. I'm sorry if it sounds kind of old-fashioned. That is what these occasions are for. So much of our lives are spent consuming things through the screen and in pointless arguments about the things we see on screens. And it's very sad to see something which can give you the greatest fun that you'll ever have in one afternoon reduced to another of those things. So the game going in this sense is a profound point. And that when we're allowed to congregate again, it's very important to reclaim those spaces and reclaim that spectacle. It's one of the few places in modern life where human beings come together and express joy, dissent, and various other kind of bestial parts of their character that they might want to shout about in public. And when we take that away, I think something has gone. So I believe the phrase, the game has gone, has not gone.
That's a better and more moving point than what I was about to make, but I'll make it anyway. Which is that I think the first example of the sentiment, if not the phrase, the game has gone, came in 1863 on December the 3rd, on the very day that the laws of the game were first compiled, when Blackheath said, well, if you're gonna get rid of hacking from the game has gone, and they left they refused to join the FA and set up the Rugby Football Union instead. So from the very first day when the game was created, the game had gone.
And yet, while you say that with a kind of mocking tone, 5 minutes ago on this very podcast, you said the game has gone because men are not allowed to hit each other with their elbows. So echoing the words of Blackheath, who were talking about kicking people in the shins. So plus ça change, plus Wilson says exactly the same thing as Blackheath 120 years ago, 140 years ago.
Well, I mean, if we're going to do the maths, 158 years ago.
See, this is far. This is the game has gone. We're arguing about
maths has gone.
Right, that'll do for part one, which was incredibly long. But we'll be back in a second, and we'll be reporting. We won't be reporting from the London Stadium. None of us are there. We're all just in our houses, looking at each other, but we can't see Barney. Anyway, we'll be back and doing West Ham Leicester in a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. West Ham 3, Leicester City 2. West Ham keep going, now just a point behind Leicester. Larry says, does Jesse Lingard score the winner at the Euros? Two more for him. His performances, Barney, and just his, you know, his stats, his goals and assists have been extraordinary.
Yeah, he's done really well. It's a really good move to a team that suits his game and his qualities. He's a really good runner. He's a great mover. And they play a really good counter-attack game. And it's an example of, I think, a player playing at the right level for him. He's a really talented player. He's now playing as the main man in their attack. He's allowed to move where he wants to. And often talented players get hoarded at clubs now. You don't really get kind of so-and-so who happens to be really good staying at West Ham for 10 years and scoring 20 goals a season, because you'll be added to the squad somewhere else and sort of stockpiled. But it's an example of a player probably at exactly the right level where he's allowed to fully express what he's really good at. We're now duty-bound to say he's the greatest player in the Premier League, which I heard someone saying on the radio the other day, and ruin that for him by suggesting he should be stockpiled somewhere else where he can come on as a sub. But he's at just the right level, and hopefully he'll get to stay there and enjoy his football.
It is quite funny, actually, because if he wasn't already a Manchester United player, he would be being linked with a £70 million move to Manchester United. So it will be interesting to see what happens next.
Speaking of players that have clearly not been stockpiled by someone else and have just stayed in one place, Mark Noble, 400th game, one club man, hits his last season next season. And it would be really... It would just be, it's a really nice story of his final season, Wilson, even if he doesn't play that much. Is West Ham in the Champions League?
Yeah, no, it'd be great for him. I mean, I don't know how much he'd get to play in the Champions League, but yeah, just to be involved around that. And I guess if they're in the Champions League, he might get more of a look in the league, because obviously they have to rotate. But yeah, he is that rare thing of a great servant of a club.
His role now is to come on with a minute left, have the armband thrown to him. He pulls it on and he runs and keeps the ball by the corner flag and is fouled. I've seen him do that probably about 17 times this season, and he's incredibly good at it. But it rests on West Ham being in a winning position so that he can run on and do that. I'm not sure the Champions League that will be their fate.
Well, I think in every game now they just go 3-0 up and then just sort of somehow hold on to that lead. Leicester didn't have James Maddison, Hamza Choudhury and Ayoze Perez. They were dropped for breaching COVID-19 protocols. Joe says, in relation to the party that meant we didn't play Maddison, Perez and Choudhury, what party would make it worth losing 7 months of hard work? Me, fake scientist, said, when Leicester bottle the top four again, should I be allowed to follow the COVID-3 around for the entire following season while ringing a bell and shouting shame? Barry?
Well, I believe it was a house party in Ayoze Perez's gaff, and that no house party is worth, you know, blowing a potential top four finish over. They're awful. You know, just, I haven't been to one in a very long time, obviously, and even if it wasn't COVID restrictions, I still wouldn't go to one, because I remember attending a lot of house parties, and I was always one of the people who was in the kitchen being an arse and sullenly drinking out of a can while everyone else was having fun. But there will probably be Leicester fans going, oh, did he have to drop them? Couldn't he just fine them or something? But I think he probably did fine them, and they won't care about a fine. And if it emerged, you know, it would have emerged if he had let them play. The story would have come out. And then he'd have got in trouble, you know, well, if you knew, why did you let them play, blah, blah, blah. So he did the right thing. And, I'm not going to criticise him for going to a party. Boys will be boys.
to Selhurst Park. Crystal Palace 1, Chelsea 4. Barney, you were there. Chelsea were brilliant. Played some scintillating football. Was this the greatest attacking performance of the Thomas Tuchel regime?
Well, Thomas Tuchel didn't think so afterwards. He was asked that question and he refused to give the easy headline. He sort of said, no, we, you know, we've played Porto, Man United, and basically Crystal Palace were not really playing football for most of the first hour. But they were really good. And it was really great to see Kai Havertz have a good game, because not only is he a very talented player and very young, he looks like a kind of minor curate from a BBC Jane Austen adaptation who eventually marries the nice girl and has a nice time. He just is a very nice lad, despite also being physically sort of quite a big unit. I mean, I think he's quite an exciting player. And he was really good in that first half. I was quite close to the touchline watching it at Selhurst Park. And some of his touches were brilliant. Like there was one little back heel and just knowing where the space was, I thought, wow, I really get why he's a good player. But he should have also scored a few more goals. And but I can see why he's playing as a false nine there. They kept the ball brilliantly and they had little overloads. And if they can play Crystal Palace every week, they should be fine.
Crystal Palace were bad, Barry. And sort of the endless conversation, you know, around this time is, does Roy hold on again? You were mentioning to me yesterday quite the number of players that are out of contract at Palace at the end of the season.
Yeah, it's difficult to know what's going to happen to them, because if you take Wilf Zaha and Eze out of that team, they're probably flattering to say they're bang average. They're just shit. And on the 30th of June, Roy Hodgson will be out of contract, as will 17 senior players, most of whom regularly start or are on the bench. So you would think they'd have put in a bit more effort against Chelsea, if only to play for another Palace contract or to get a contract somewhere else. None of them are making convincing arguments that they deserve them, and next season could be an absolute car crash for Palace, depending on what happens over the summer.
Well, there's an odd thing with them, isn't there? That, you know, we think of Hodgson's side as being very well organised and very well drilled, but they've lost 7 games this season by 3 or more goals out of the 31 league games, which suggests that, you know, a quarter of the time they're not particularly well drilled or well organised.
Barney, you mentioned off air Ray Lewington was very noisy.
Oh yeah, he's always very noisy, and it was like being on the face of the moon at Selhurst Park on Saturday afternoon. It was so incredibly cold, but he was still there in his very short shorts, standing there, and he's great because he shouts, like, he's always shouting at the fullbacks because they're nearest, like, go on, Pat, yes, Pat. He's always shouting Pat. He likes Pat, and he loves Eze, who he calls Eze. And it's really encouraging, really encouraging. And then they were 2-0 down suddenly within 2 minutes. And he went really quiet for it. And he just stood there. And then it took about a minute for him to be back. Go on, Pat, go on, Pat. And I kind of have this feeling that he thinks if he stops shouting, all the players will stop moving. It's like a kind of dark magic. Like he has to keep, he's powering them with his shouting. And if he stops for 1 second, they'll all just lie down.
Maybe that was the problem on Saturday, that if it was like the surface of the moon, of course you wouldn't be able to hear him shouting because of the it would be a vacuum.
Well, I was going to say, even though he's shouting, he's a very lovable figure. And it's not like having an angry dad shouting at you. I think the players genuinely kind of like it. And when he goes, it's going to be like the Ravens leaving. There'll be something. He's recreating a crowd all on his own in filling Selhurst Park. When he goes, it will be a very sad moment.
Liverpool 2, Aston Villa 1. Trent Alexander-Arnold scored a last-minute winner, Barry, which obviously means he's now the best right-back in England.
Yes, absolutely. I kind of talked about Trent Alexander-Arnold last week. I think he's a very good player. He wouldn't look out of place in the England squad for the Euros. He probably isn't going to be in it, but at least Gareth Southgate was there on Saturday to see him, and he didn't do himself his chances of making the squad any harm whatsoever.
So that win means that Liverpool are sixth, 52 points, Chelsea on 54, West Ham 55, Leicester 56, Tottenham 49 from 31, Everton 47 from 29. Who do you think is going to get in the top four, Barney? And do you think also, but before we move on from Liverpool, I thought it was quite interesting that people sort of wrote Liverpool's top four chances off pretty prematurely, given that they are still a good football team.
Well, I think Jurgen Klopp wrote them off, didn't he? At one point he said it was going to take a miracle for us to get into the top four. And they lost six home games in a row, I think it was. So I mean, it wasn't that surprising. You might think, well, this team's not having a very good season. And they look spooked. But I think that they will make it into the top four. And I think Chelsea will too. I think that'll be it. And I think Leicester are on the collapse again. When you see Brendan Rodgers' kind of wounded, sad face, you kind of know things. He's got that kind of passive-aggressive, I have been wronged. It reminds me of my old Hungarian grandmother. She had a similar face. I've been wronged for 90 years, and it's your fault. And I'm enjoying being wronged. And there's kind of something of that. It's a great face, and I think it's very powerful. But I think it ultimately has a destructive effect on his football teams. And I feel for Leicester. I think they're a really good team, but I think they might be caught.
But Barney, you love is it a metaphor or a simile? I can never remember. You know, woodland animals, and I think Rodgers looks more like a small furry woodland animal than any other manager, or indeed human being I've ever seen.
Yeah, he's pushing Gareth Southgate in waistcoat. Is he not driving a tiny little car along the riverbank there for you? But he's definitely up there. Yeah, I'd go with
that. See, Gareth Southgate is enjoying, you know, we've talked about how much football there is. As far as I can tell, he's at every football match. Now that every match that I'm watching, they cut to Gareth Southgate in the crowd. Do you think he gets home and goes, oh no, I've got to go to that one? And there's a lot of travel as well, isn't there? He must be shattered.
Yeah, but he probably has a driver. He gets a nice lunch. You know, he gets the VIP treatment. It's not like us, you know, tramping around from ground to ground, being treated contemptuously.
He's having a brilliant time. And when they say he sent a message there to the watching Gareth Southgate, he literally are sending it, because he's the only person watching. He's the only member of the crowd. So you literally are sending directly. I mean, you could point at him, saying you could hold up a message. And you everything you do is literally sending a message to this one earnest-looking guy in a black mask in the stand.
It'd be great if Trent Alexander-Arnold had a T-shirt on that said, "Are you watching Gareth?" And he'd ripped it off in the last minute and then just stood there. Because Gareth would have had to say, yes, I am.
or if he ran over to where Gareth is sitting and like sort of cupped his ears behind in that gesture of defiance.
Wilson, who's getting the top four for you?
Chelsea and Liverpool.
All right.
I mean, I've got to be right about West Ham eventually, haven't I? This can't keep going on. West Ham could do it. They've now... The implausibility of this season for them has gone on long enough. I'm prepared to take the "im" off the start of that word and believe it is plausible they could get top four. I think Antonio being out, however long that's for, I think that's a problem for them. And Declan Rice the same. The fact that they keep struggling to hold on to 3-0 leads, I wonder if that suggests something about their fitness, which I think has been a question about Moyes for a long time. And maybe the last sort of 20% of the season that will be felt more. But you know, they've defied logic this far, so who's to say they can't do it for another 7 games?
All right, that'll do for part 2. Part 3 we'll do the relegation. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Burnley 1, Newcastle 2. Massive win for Newcastle this, Barry. And all about Alan Saint-Maximin, who came on and was brilliant.
I mean, they were pretty rubbish until he came on and Callum Wilson. Just relying on slinging crosses into the box, which isn't going to trouble Burnley unduly at any point, you'd imagine. And then he came on, was given the freedom of the field to weave his magic, and that's exactly what he did. Newcastle don't have too many classy players, but he is undeniably one of them. And I suppose Steve Bruce has to get credit for making the substitution, changing the game. There will be Newcastle fans who refuse to give him credit, as is their right. But the last two games, I think he's done pretty well.
We shouldn't forget, but they are a completely different team with him on the pitch. He totally changes their threat. He's a really good player. And I'm really pleased for him. He's had suffered really badly. He had COVID and it affected him in a kind of long, long way, I think. And he just seems like such a nice bloke as well. I think it's possible to feel genuinely pleased with him. If I could be friends with a Premier League player, I think I'd like to be friends with him. He seems very nice.
I think when he came, he came with a bad reputation as a bit of a tantrum thrower and difficult to work with. But he seems absolutely fine, as Barry, like a real nice guy. So I'm not sure where that rep came from, or maybe he's changed his ways. I don't know what he was like in France.
I really like the way in his post-match interview he referred to Joe Willock as "We Look." I had a joke with "We Look."
How, Barney, on your first play date with Alan Saint-Maximin, what will you do?
We'd probably play football, but that wouldn't last very long. We'd probably stop, Alan, stop. We're not going to play football anymore. That's enough. And then probably just like kick around, play the Xbox, you know.
I reckon he'd enjoy going down for a spell in the nets with you and Wilson and your son, Barney. You could teach him the finer points of cricket.
Yeah, he'd probably be annoyingly good at that as well, wouldn't he? Like, oh, I'm terribly sorry, I'm just very good at this.
Well, your son's annoyingly good at that, to be fair.
Yeah, he's not bad. He's not bad.
He's too good for me. I mean, far too good for me these days.
Oh, you should see him these days. He's absolutely terrifying.
I don't want to. He's terrifying. He's about 10.
Is that because you've actually fed him, Barney?
They're quite the opposite. It's my brutal, vicious regime of starvation.
Question from Nick. What qualifies as stooping? According to the PGMOL, James Tarkowski can freely kick an opponent in the face. So as long as that opponent isn't standing rigidly upright, like they've had all of their vertebrae fused together. What's the answer?
I'd say if your face is lower than your waist, then you're fair game for a kicking.
Okay, that's Barry's parenting. That's Barry's parenting.
I think they've got this absolutely right that we're going to rule out goals for caressing somebody's cheek with your fingers, but if you smash them in the face with your foot, that's not a foul. I think once again, football has been proportionate in its response to these two, you know, entirely different situations.
You could say the same about Fernandinho's foul on Rafinha in the Leeds game, and compared to the foul that got who was the
Liam Cooper?
Liam Cooper yeah. Sent off. I thought Fernandinho's was worse, but there you go.
I mean, I don't think it was a foul because football is a game played with the feet, and it was a legitimate attempt to kick the ball. And once you stop telling players not to try and kick the ball, it all kind of falls apart, really.
Yeah, I'm all for sin bins for the Fernandinho cynical tackle. I would send off Liam Cooper and I'd put Fernandinho in the bin for 10 minutes.
Well, the thing with Fernandinho, I mean, this obviously isn't the law as it stands at the moment, but it's a yellow card for being cynical, and it also should be a yellow card for the violence of the offence. I mean, you know, he clatters into his thigh with his knee. So I somehow, because the two offences sort of coalesce into one offence, it just becomes a big yellow card. Whereas I think that is, I mean, as bad as the Cooper one, because the Cooper one, although I think it was correctly given as a red card, it is sort of accidental. He's slightly out of control. So I think the Fernandinho one, because it's sort of preconceived, yeah, it's premeditated, I think is in some moral sense worse.
What about the notion of double jeopardy? You're going to punish someone twice for one offence. It was a single act. How can you? You're punishing for his mental state when he committed that act because it was deliberately cynical.
Personally, I think if for those kind of fouls the referee does bring out a big yellow card, like a commemorative check, even if it's worth the same as a normal yellow card, I'm all in favour of that.
And the advantage of that is you can get the whole team to sign it rather than just one player.
Exactly right. Think of the money you could raise for charity. That win for Newcastle means they're 6 points clear of Fulham, who lost at home to Wolves. Adama Traore in injury time, agony, Barry, for Scott Parker. And another one of his, I mean, every time he speaks, all I can think of is the streets, putting his words to the streets. But this was one of his finest.
Yeah, well, that was agony for him, and it was agony for those of us who had to watch the game, which was awful. They should have just dispensed with both halves and played the added time from both halves and left it at that, because they were the only moments of interest in the game, the 2 or 3 minutes at the end of each half. I do remember Scott Parker, the original post-match interview that was put to Dry Your Eyes. He talked about, you know, how football was all-consuming, and that the only time he had to enjoy himself was, you know, having a Chinese and a glass of beer or wine with his wife on a Saturday evening. And I every time Fulham get another kick in the teeth now, I just think it's Mrs. Parker I feel sorry for, trying to cheer up her very, very downcast husband as he, you know, prods his chicken chow mein with a fork and sips unenthusiastically at his glass of Rioja. And I can imagine her there trying to lift his spirits, but doing so in vain. But yeah, Fulham just haven't been good enough. I thought they would be fine, but I was wrong.
I didn't see this game, but I'm assuming that Scott Parker looked really good during the 2 minute silence.
Oh, almost certainly. Yeah, I mean,
he's got that sort of, he looks like a minor royal retainer already. He's got an incredibly solemn, brilliantly set jaw, and he dresses immaculately.
On to the game that didn't matter. Sheffield United 0, Arsenal 3. Lacazette's goals were lovely, Barry, weren't they? And, you know, off the back of that disappointing Europa League draw at home to Slavia Prague, that must have been nice for the Arsenal fans, etc.
This game, I didn't see, and the reason I didn't see it is because I just could not be arsed watching it. Arsenal are no longer worthy of my time, and Sheffield United are already relegated, so what was the point?
I think you summed it up pretty perfectly, to be honest. I mean, look, I think you probably would have watched it if it had been the Saturday 5:30. I think any game that's put on the Sunday at 7:15.
I don't think I would. I'm so sick of Arsenal that I just cannot be bothered watching them. Nothing they do interests me anymore. They're so useless.
Their young players are fun, aren't they? They've got exciting young players.
I think it's a bit harsh, yeah. I've quite enjoyed watching some of those young players, and, you know, there's something interesting in the kind of psychodrama of Arteta's crumbling and but still monumental self-esteem as he realises it's quite hard to be a manager. But I didn't watch this live because I think it's a terrible time to put a football match on television. And I think we should all boycott such times and refuse to, because they'll try and retain these times when everybody's still trying to travel to the stadium, and I reject it.
Do you think they will? I really hope they get rid of this.
If they get the chance, yeah, because it's good for television, and that's all that matters. So it's important to resist them, and to one of the many things that should be. We should take back control of.
Is it good for television, though? Because my feeling is that most people don't want to watch a game at that time on a Sunday, that there are better things to do.
But the reason it's on is because there is a presumption it will be good for them to show it.
On to any other business. Johnny says, in regards to the red card at Bradford Grimsby this weekend, have you ever had the urge to headbutt a fellow pod member, and why? Grimsby, the bottom club, were reduced from the BBC website. The bottom club were reduced to 10 men after Stephen Payne was sent off at the end of the first half for appearing to headbutt his own teammate, former Bradford winger Felipe Moraes. Cambridge had that. At Brentford away, we lost 6-0 and Paul Rayner was sent off for headbutting Mick Heathcote. It's quite the disappointment when one of your own players headbutts another of his teammates.
I've never headbutted anybody, but I kind of admire the courage of anyone who does, because I always assume I'd be the one who'd get hurt rather than the person I'm butting.
Hmm.
You aim for the nose, Barry. You understand that bit of it, right?
The secret is to apply the hard bit of your head to the soft bit of their head.
Yeah, I just wouldn't be confident that I'd be able with to pull it nose. Off.
Yeah, no, me neither. It's very unnatural.
When Jack Charlton was a young teen, he became convinced his head was harder than normal, and he went around boasting about it till somebody challenged him to prove it. So he headbutted the ground with disastrous consequences.
Depends on, you know, had there been a lot, what was the going? Was the going good to soft or?
Well, it was hard enough that it clearly prevented him from boasting about the hardness of his head thereafter.
Peter says, tell us about Phil Brown's sabbatical. Is Phil Brown is back in management at Southend, and he looked brilliant, Wilson, didn't he?
Well, there's an episode of Lewis. It's the one where, what's she called, the pathologist? Dr. Hobson, is that right? You know, the pathologist that Lewis ends up with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it is.
It's all people she was at university with and people she shared a house with when she was at university get involved in this mystery. And one of them is this sort of very louche, failed painter who lives on a canal boat, played by Rupert Graves. And basically, yeah, Phil Brown looked like he was auditioning for that role. And I think he'd be excellent in it. I mean, Rupert Graves is obviously, you know, a very talented actor and was very good in the role. But, you know, I think
also,
Phil Brown,
Rupert Graves, who I quite often play five-a-side with, is a thoroughly lovely man.
Is he?
Yeah.
Well, he's a very good actor, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Very good at reading words off a bit of paper.
Hugh says, when Barry corrected Archie on Thursday's show, pointing out that it was, in fact, he who was rushing past the countryside, it belied Barry's poor understanding of Einsteinian physics. There is no absolute position in space. It is all relative to the observer. Barry?
Fair enough. I have no understanding of Einsteinian physics. Not a clue.
Tell us about online Scrabble being a football dinosaur, Barry.
Yeah, I downloaded a Scrabble app to my phone the other day, and I've been playing a bit. And I tried to use the word, I was trying to use the letter X, you know, I think it's 10-pointer, and there was a G available, so I
it's
put
an eight,
X.
It's an 8-pointer, X.
Okay. Hmm. I was trying to use the letter X, an 8-pointer, triple letter score, and there was a G available, so I put down XG, expected goals, wouldn't accept it. So, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, there's so much wrong with this. So the G was already on the triple word score, so you only got 10 points. You wouldn't have got 30-odd. And also the G is a capital G in expected goals, so it was never going to be allowed. I think not only has your ignorance of Einsteinian physics been exposed today, but also your ignorance of the basics of Scrabble.
But I mean, the really interesting thing is where online Scrabble sits in, you know, that sort of debate, as Barney was trying to say, you know, this sort of binary debate between sort of football dinosaur and football hipster, in that it won't accept XG, but it also won't accept VAR. And so where is online Scrabble? Perhaps it's in the right place.
Does it accept register?
the real sadness is I still somewhere in the back of my mind have a vision of Barry as a slightly dangerous figure. The Brixton gunslinger, you know, pulling on his fag. And phrases like I downloaded an online Scrabble app to my smartphone the other day. They just kind of shatter that world. They just push that world a little further away from me. And there's a sadness.
So I'm not as edgy as you think.
No, but I'm still clinging to that.
How is your ISA going, Barry?
Well, my ISA is in the black.
Oh, that's good.
Sensational news. Well, yeah, but my investments went up 2.16% last week. Well, it was a great week last
interestingly,
week.
Interestingly, I mentioned, didn't I, on a pod, that my friend Martin, who works in pensions, was very concerned about your ISA. I then got a text from another friend, Martin, who also works in pensions. I don't want to sound any edgier than I possibly could to have more than one friend, Martin, who works in pensions. But he was similarly concerned, but was also slightly surprised because he hadn't messaged me about your ISA, and he was wondering how I'd heard from him about your ISA when he hadn't mentioned me. But there you go. I only have two friends, Martin, who work in pensions.
I was going to say, your third friend called Martin who works in pensions will now be ringing you up saying, that's a lie, I didn't even call you at all.
Anyway, this sounds like a good point to end the podcast. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time.
Cheers, thank you.
Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
Barney, thank you.
Cheers, bye everyone.
We'll be back on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.